This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
This episode of the Baby Tribe Podcast is proudly sponsored by HappyTummy.ie, the exclusive distributor of BioGaia probiotics for babies.
That's right. And as parents ourselves, we know how crucial it is to prioritize our children's health. BioGaia probiotics have been clinically proven to support digestive health and reduce the duration of crying in babies experiencing colic.
Absolutely, and HappyTummy.ie makes it incredibly convenient for parents to access these products.
Amazing! So for all your probiotic needs, head on over to HappyTummy.ie.
And Baby Tribe listeners can enjoy a 10% discount on all products at HappyTummy.ie with the code BABYTRIBE10. Okay, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Baby Tribe Podcast, your essential companion through the journey of parenting. I'm Professor Afif Al-Kafash, a neonatologist, paediatrician, researcher and lactation consultant at the Rotunda Hospital Dublin and the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland.
And I'm Katie Mugan, a paediatric and public health nurse and a lactation consultant. Together, with over 40 years of experience in caring for infants and children, we're here to share expert insights, inspiring stories and give you access to an amazing array of experts in parenting and the field of paediatrics.
Before we dive into today's topic, remember to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform. Your ratings and reviews help us reach more parents like you, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Now, let's get started with today's episode. Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Baby Tribe Podcast. Thank you so much for all the wonderful feedback we've been getting. We really, really enjoy doing it. Katie, how are you doing this week?
Good, Afif. All going well. Although I was in my parents yesterday and one of my kids just had one of those moments and had a meltdown. They were tired anyway.
How convenient in our parenting style parenting style episodes.
Yeah, I'm telling you. Well, we brought it to the forefront this
time. This definitely was not planned.
This was not planned. Well, it's probably a regular occurrence now, in fairness, in our house. Somebody has a breakdown at some stage, but I happen to be my parents. And, you know, we have very different parenting techniques. And when the child, we won't mention who, was having a moment, I was like, one. So I definitely do the counting. I go, one, two, three. Usually by three, we get to five, but usually by three, they've stopped or they calmed and we chat about it and we work it out. But my father then piped in from the chair. God, she's great at counting, isn't she?
Amazing.
Amazing. And I was like, well, Dad, what do you want me to do? I could go down the old style of just, you know, let it go or stop. But we joke about it all the time. But we have very different parenting styles. I don't know about you, Afif, because you're obviously a different culture, you know, what you feel. But I can definitely say my parenting style to my parents is very different.
I remember that we used to fear the counting when we were kids. Like the counting meant something very, very different back then. Because what if you got to three, you knew that you got to three and you were punished. Because I think here, now I think we don't actually double down. We may continue counting up to 10 sometimes, you know, if kids don't oblige, I'm going to keep counting and there's never a consequence. And, you know, I don't think counting has the same effect that it had before.
I haven't gotten to five. Well,
have you not?
Well, you see, Jack, no, he kind of knows by if I get to three. But
so okay, this is the question.
I suppose if there was something really bad, like if there was a hitting or you don't get counting for that. So obviously, I can't remember what he'd done yesterday, but something not major, but enough for me to go, I think it was that he wouldn't put a shoe. I can't even remember what it was, but he would not cooperate. And I was like, right, one, two. By the time I get to three, he stops.
Okay.
But no, I have another child, one of the others.
Yeah.
He's our ball breaker. Like he's disciplined different to the others. Like the others, you just give them to three and they've all stopped.
Yeah.
He knows how to keep going. So he might get to 10.
Okay.
Or we find, to be honest, there's a different parenting style with him. He's just, it doesn't work.
So do you regard yourself as an Irish mammy?
Oh, my mother is a real Irish mammy. No, I hope I don't turn into the Irish mammy. Like as in really lovely and affectionate, but oh no, she's a disaster. She's an enabler, we call her.
Oh, really? In what way?
Did you never hear the Irish mammy and their sons?
Yes.
Oh, my God. No, she still to this day would do it. Yeah, no, I'd never be like that.
I know. It's funny. The Irish mammy and the Arab mammy are quite similar in a lot of ways, but they're also quite different in many other ways.
I had Luke and Lily, and Tom must have been brand new born. And we had sold our house and we were waiting to get into our new house. And I think there was like a month delay. So I had stayed, we were staying with my parents. And at the time, Jim was living between Cork and our up in Nace because he worked in Cork. So he's gone for half the month. So he'd go. And then when he came back, And I was trying to kind of, you know, not put too much pressure on my parents. So I like, I'll cook dinner with Jack, with Tom, newborn, in the carrier. I'd be like, no, mom, it's fine. I'll do it. So I'd be making dinner and she'd let me. But when Jim came home, oh no, like I was thinking, Jim, you can take over here. I'm actually burnt out. I am frazzled. And he'd be like, I never get it. I come back up and it's like, sit down, Jim. No, absolutely, you won't do it. He'd been down in Cork on his own, sleeping every night, 12 hours a night or whatever he got, and managing no problem while I was actually running like a headless chicken, serving not only my kids, I was serving everyone else with it. And my mother would think nothing of it. But when Jim came home, you sit down, Jim, you relax. No, no, it's not up to you. God. And then when he did, he'd be like, oh, isn't he amazing?
Isn't he amazing?
Isn't he amazing that he cooked dinner? I'm like, excuse me?
I know.
Hello?
I know. Whenever my my mother-in-law rings Anne and Anne says, oh, Fief's cooking me dinner, she goes, isn't he amazing? And I just love that.
It drives me crazy. When I look, I'll take a step back here because I will say that I'm now roles reversed in that Jim has taken over since COVID and everything happened and I'm working my own business. Jim does nearly everything at home and my mother still, like, she praises him. You are so lucky. You are so lucky. He does so much around the house. I'm like, well, mom, if he wasn't, then I would be doing it.
And you are, Katie. I agree. You are so lucky. Jim is an unsung hero. Absolutely.
I hope he never listens to this.
Jim, if you're listening, you are a hero.
My neighbors are all saying, oh my God, we all want a Jim. I'm like, no, no, no.
Yeah.
I know, we do.
I know. It's pretty
funny.
Go
on, tell us about the Arab mommy, though.
Arab mommies do the exact same thing for their boys, except the one big difference I've noticed is that Irish mommies tell you what they think and how they're feeling in a very, very roundabout way. Like, it takes ages for them to kind of get the message across. It's in like...
It's not direct.
It's not direct, whereas Arab mommies are direct.
Okay, go on, give us an example.
They will tell you what they're thinking, no filters whatsoever. And thank God that Anne has thick skin because I don't think we'd still be married. Oh my God. I mean, don't get me wrong. They love each other. They get on like a house on fire. But because you know where you stand with my mother. So when we got engaged, my mother was like, I must meet this woman that you have, you know, gotten engaged to. So we flew.
Had she met her before?
Nope. Nope. Anne has never been to the Middle East. She was absolutely terrified, appropriately so. So we're flying from Dublin via London to Kuwait. And she met my mother. And first thing my mother said to her was, welcome. I told my son three things before he went to Ireland. I told him not to do medicine. I told him not to leave the country. And I told him not to marry a white girl. And he disobeyed me on all three fronts. Welcome to the family.
Wow.
I know.
Cutting.
Well, there's no going back after that. You know exactly where you stand. So the relationship has blossomed.
Did they hug then?
Since. Yes, they did. They did. Yeah. It was all fine after that. But then sets the tone and then there you go.
We are pausing for a moment to announce that the Baby Tribe is now part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, Katie. It is nice to feel wanted and sought after. We are delighted to be joining the network that actually won the Best Network Award at the recent Irish Podcast Awards.
That's right, Afif, and they are celebrating their 10-year anniversary this year, so it's lovely to join them at such a momentous juncture. We look forward to being part of an amazing family of like-minded people and fabulous podcasts.
And we are now in a position to offer our listeners bonus content via Headstuff Plus. By subscribing, you will help us do more with our podcast and grow. But more importantly, you will get access to our bonus material in the form of a spin-off podcast. And you'll get a heap of bonus content from every show on the network, regardless of which show you support.
Yes, Afif, but there is a twist. I can only handle so much time with you, so I have drafted in backup to help me.
Hello, listeners. This is Anne, Afif's better half. I decided to join Afif to keep him in check and take the burden off poor Katie here. She's already deeply traumatized by the amount of time she's had to spend with him.
That is very true, Anne.
Yeah. So if you subscribe, you will be treated to a fabulous husband and wife. A fabulous wife discussion with a little bit of a husband involved.
I love this.
Yeah. And we'll expand on points raised in the Baby Tribe and we'll throw in a little bit of science as well. The odd bit of abuse that I have to give Afif, well deserved. But Afif, what did you decide to call the bonus podcast?
So I've been waiting for over 10 years for this moment, so thank you for bringing it up. I've decided to call the podcast Keeping Up with the Kafashians.
Oh my God. That's it, Afif. That is the lamest thing I've heard in so long.
Look, I know there's another family that kind of sound the same, but I feel that they have copied the name from me rather than the other way around. But anyway.
Anne, any comments?
I had nothing to do with this. This is all him.
It's an amazing name. Please subscribe.
Join the Cast is back for its last stage. It's your turn to decide which will be your new favorite podcast. Whether you're into ghosts, fashion, GAA, anthropology, or the meaning behind names, just go to jointhecast.ie and vote for your favorite. The winner will get a podcast series worth €50,000 and will join Headstuff Podcasts. Vote now at jointhecast.ie.
So we are actually talking about different parenting styles. And I think it's a very important issue because, as you know, Ireland is becoming a lot more diverse. Yeah. We have a lot more cultures. And both as parents and as healthcare providers, I think it's important to recognize the different parenting styles. So when I was researching this, I've actually come across some very interesting parenting styles from across the globe. And I'm going to throw you a few zingers and see what you think. Did you know that in Denmark, the parents leave their babies outside in strollers while they dine or shop?
Yes, I did know that.
I had no
idea.
They
really believe in outside sleep.
Yeah, but they leave them alone.
Yeah, but yeah. They're all in areas, but it's considered very safe.
Designated areas. You imagine doing that in Dublin, leaving your child outside.
Child protection.
Yeah, child outside, like outside.
Too slow will be called ASAP.
Yeah, and in the same vein, like in Norway, they let their babies take naps in the cold because they believe that it's actually good for you. Finland, school children have a break for 15 minutes every 45 minutes.
Well, I actually think we'd have a lot less stressed out teachers and a lot happier kids.
Yeah, and they feel that it really, really improves your focus.
Yeah, I agree with that totally.
And there are a lot of cultures around the world, you know, Hong Kong, India, Taiwan, a lot of, you know, Spain, Portugal, Latin America, where the kids have much, much later bedtime, up to 11 or, you know, 11, 12 o'clock.
Well, actually on that, I still remember my aunt not giving out, but making a comment because her son is married to a French lady and they would always have dinner quite late and the bedtime would be much later. So we're here in Ireland, it's 7, 8, 9 at the latest kind of thing. They would probably be 9, 10. They would only be eating their dinner at 8 or 9 and then bed at 10 or that. And she was like, oh, it's ridiculous and they have to change. And no wonder that they're upset or whatever. But the kids generally had a bit of a rest period in the afternoon of the day. Yeah. So just very different cultures.
And I think the reason they say it is because if they go to bed early, they actually miss out on vital family time because a lot of activities and fun things happen in the evening. Very similar in Kuwait. When we travel back to Kuwait, the kids love it because, you know,
there's no bedtime.
No bedtime. But the culture is the kids stay up much, much later. They stay with the adults, they stay up and they kind of participate in a lot of the activities.
Are they not wrecked though?
They are, but you know.
Then we pay for it.
Yeah, exactly. The parents now, not the Irish in general. In France, I love this because my kids are the fussiest eaters. Fussiness is just not tolerated in France. The kids are given something and they just have to eat it. And fussiness is just not tolerated there at all.
They would be good eaters though as well. Like they would eat a lot of fresh fruits and fresh veg, like on all their meals. Like I'm astounded. We've gone to France for years on holidays and they've got big bowls of mussels. Like the kids are eating bowls of mussels and like vegetables all beside them. And there's my kids and they're eating chicken nuggets and chips. And I'm like, oh, where did I go wrong?
My kids still pick vegetable bits out of their bolognese if you add like chunky vegetable bits. So and I'm like,
onions. My kids are allergic. It's like, oh my God, there's an onion. And so now Jim does that. He zooms everything. So there's no fight. He goes, I just can't deal with it anymore. Yeah. So he makes it all up and zooms so nobody sees the peppers and the onions and all that. And I'm like, Luke's 13 now. Like,
I still blend the stuff in. And in fairness to Anne, she's done with this. She now hands them something.
Oh yeah.
And you're like, you either eat it or you go hungry.
Well, we are kind of on that. Even now, we kind of go, there's your dinner. You eat it or you don't eat it. Because now Jack has gotten to that picky stage where he would eat anything beforehand. Yeah. And now he looks and goes, I don't like that.
And you know, it's nothing to do with them not liking the food.
No, he loves it.
We actually caught their bluff because they're now in a school that provides lunches for them. So we're not in control of their lunches. We have to pay for it, but they get it. And I was like to my son, so what did you have in school? Oh, I had chili with black bean sauce and some vegetables and some red peppers. And I was like, excuse me, did you eat it all? Yeah, it was delicious.
if you cooked it. Yeah, but that's like kids in creche. You know, when you see them, they go, well, they eat everything in creche, but when they come home, they won't eat anything. I'm like, that's perfectly normal. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. And in Japan, kids use public transport from the age of 6 or 7 on their own.
So this is actually, my brother lives in Prague and his kids, so the 13 and 10, and they have been using public transport from, I'd say, maybe even 8 or 9 on their own. And I'm like, what? And Dave's like, that's how they do it. Or, which I find really strange, they go on school tours for 2 weeks or 3 weeks on their own, no parents, from the age of 6 onwards.
Wow.
Which I find, really? You let them go? And he goes, yeah, it's just standard. They're kind of harsh. Well, not, I say harsh, but they're not harsh.
Yeah.
But their practices are.
And it's funny. So when I, and just to show you how relative everything is, when I came here, I mean, in Kuwait, there's no public transport at all. So you're driven everywhere by your parents, or you get taxis once you're much, much older. Having children, even as old as 14, 15, 16, take public transport on their own was a foreign concept to me. Going, what do you mean we're sending Maggie on her own at 14 on a bus? No way. And Anne was like, chill out, dude. It's just, this is what happens, you know? And then I see in Japan that they do it at the age of 6 or 7.
I'd be afraid they get on the wrong bus or somebody would take them.
I know, it's crazy.
They'd probably drop them back to me.
But it's a lot safer in Japan.
Is it?
I mean, Japan is very safe.
I've never been to Japan, actually.
Yeah, I'd love to go. Liechtenstein, school starts at the age of 7.
Yet. Well, I think that's quite, though, there's a few, they do preschool up to it, but they only start reading and everything else from 7.
There's nothing up at until all. 7 at all. Yet they maintain 100% literacy rate.
Yes.
It just shows you that, you know, I'm sure they have other.
Yeah, because Dave's kids didn't start school till 7. They don't start reading till 8.
Yeah.
And then, but they're reading like immediately.
Yeah. And that's why I think it's important to show that there's a vast array of child rearing practices around the world. It's funny because you wonder why are there so many different practices? And when I was thinking about it, I think it's because it's actually shaped by your cultural beliefs, your traditions and your modern influences. And our goal as parents is to raise our kids into effective adults. But the lines of what an effective adult is becoming blurred, because I think a lot of the cultures are mixing now. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to highlight this and talk about this in this episode is you may raise a child to be effective in a certain culture and society, but then if they move to a different culture and society, they may be completely ineffective. And I probably had a personal experience with this in that I grew up in a very different way of upbringing, a different culture, and we learn how to raise our kids from our parents a lot of the time. We often find ourselves turning into our parents. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you are removed from your culture into a different one, that's when I think it becomes a little bit challenging. And it's important to highlight because there's a lot of diverse cultures there and people are meeting. And because I remember when I first went into medical school in 1996, I was the only Arab in the class.
Yeah, I'd say so.
You know, and now it's unheard of not to have maybe 20 or 30% of people to be from the Middle East in a lot of different medical schools. So things are changing significantly. And understanding these differences, I think, for better global awareness and empathy is important because it impacts child development, it impacts family dynamics. So knowing how culture ties people together, for better or for worse, can have a significant impact on raising well-adjusted children. And I think we need to have flexibility in how we do things because, you know, when you look at the different parenting styles and they can sometimes be categorized into different categories, which sometimes works just, I think, for research and being theoretical about things. But a lot of the time it's a mixture of the two. I mean, we've described how you can be either, authoritarian or authoritative. So would you regard yourself as an authoritarian parent or an authoritative parent? So
authoritarian is more open kind of, and more reasoning, isn't it?
Authoritative, actually. Authoritative parenting is characterized by a balance of responsiveness and demandingness, where as an authoritative parent, you do set clear standards and you do set limits for your children, but you recognize their children's autonomy. You're supportive. You're willing to provide children with feedback if they misbehave and explain why they misbehave. Whereas an authoritarian parent, on the other hand, is marked by high levels of demand and low levels of responsiveness. So what that means is you expect obedience without question.
You're told to do something and you do it.
You're told to do something and you do it. And I don't like that division because I think certain situations sometimes dictate that you choose one parenting style.
Yes.
Over
yes,
another.
So if a child hits, absolutely not allowed. It's not tolerated. There's no kind of like there's no waiting around to say, no, that's okay, love. You know, I would still ask why you did it, because obviously sometimes it's there's something that led to them, you know, belting out. But I would say I'm probably more authoritarian. Is that what it is?
Authoritative is the disciplining one.
No, the other one.
The other one, the authoritative. Yes. They're very close. They're a bit confusing.
I wish, yes. Yeah. So I would say I am that, but my parents, and I think a lot of older generation here in Ireland would be more disciplining. So even I remember being in my mother-in-law's, who is absolutely fabulous. She's the nicest woman. However, watch, you know, if she says something, you do it. And I can't remember what my beautiful child did or what he said, oh, I don't know what it was. But anyway, I obviously sometimes I give them a choice. I said, you know, you had the choice. He goes, but I didn't know what you never gave me a choice. I didn't know what it was. And she jumped in and then said, he doesn't have a choice. He's just told what to do. And I was like, well, OK, that's not what we do here. And I was kind of going, we'll just stick with our own. But it can be very difficult when you're in a position. I think loads of parents out there will agree. If you're with other people, and it could be your own family or friends, and you discipline differently to what they discipline, or you parent differently to what they do, you will hear comments. You will have comments coming back going, she's soft. God, she doesn't do anything. They don't listen to her at all.
Yeah.
So it really does depend. But no, I would say I'm probably more open. I would definitely, we have boundaries, we have lines. But sometimes I think we could ignore quite a lot of some behavior and just focus on the ones that we really need to focus on.
And I think society as in general, but a lot more in the Western culture, I think we're moving from authoritarian, where you tell people what to do, to more of an authoritative approach. And you know, when our kids were young, and even now, I'm a lot more authoritarian. You might be surprised to hear that, because I'm such a nice and easygoing guy, versus my wife, who is very authoritative. And I think I see that the authoritative is what works, especially when they are able to have a discussion. Well, why can't I do this? You just can't. Well, that's not an, they don't accept that anymore.
So that's you, is it?
That's me. Oh, yeah.
That's Jim. Yeah. Jim is like black and white.
Yeah, I'm very black and white. In fact, I'm pretty much described as black and white a lot of the time with my parenting. And I'm trying to, why can't I get a bus? Well, you just can't, because I say so. But
well,
why?
The kids laugh and say Jim's default position is no.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they always go, ask mom first.
Yes. Yeah. So that's disciplining. And then I was also interested to look at the second division in terms of parenting style, which is the collectivist versus the individualist. So the collectivist approach in parenting is when you emphasize community, family, and group goals over individual desires. And this style often involves teaching children the importance of cooperation, social harmony, and placing group needs above personal ones. In contrast, individualist approaches focus on fostering individuality, self-expression, and personal achievement. So parents with this approach encourage independent personal choice and self-reliance in their children.
Now, put that in simple context for people out there to understand. The collective is what you kind of represented, what you came from.
Yeah, but I was actually quite surprised to see that although the collectivist approach is usually ascribed to Eastern cultures and the individualist approach is ascribed to Western cultures, I actually, when I first came to Ireland, and even, you know, seeing how the older generation parented, it's more of a collective than an individualist approach, because it's the everybody rears everybody's children, you know, and, you know, a child may have a lot of different caregivers. You know, you may look after your neighbor's kids for a while, you may look after your nieces and nephews and things like that. But I think we are moving slowly into an individualist approach just because of the way that we live. What do you think?
I think 100%. I think years gone by, it was a collective. I think I grew up in an estate, and on our road, everyone knew everyone. Like, my mom was gone somewhere, one of the neighbors would have us. When we were out in the road, everyone watched everyone else's kids. It was very much that way. I remember my mom saying her sister was in hospital and she took her three kids in. They went to school down with us for a while until everything was better. So like, it was very much everyone just took the kids in, everyone looked after each other. But I think that's gone now. I do think that now, to a certain extent, I think there's more people don't know their neighbors. I think you've got more people moving out of their communities into like into towns, large estates. Nobody has a connection anymore, or very little. So you are kind of creating more individualized approach.
Yeah. To parenting. I think we're still maintaining some sort of collective approach when it comes to family.
Yes.
But when it comes to your community and your neighbors, yeah, I think that's happening less and less so because, you know, my wife grew up in Mayo in the west of Ireland, and she used to say that her mum and the neighbors were so closely knit. Everybody's door was open.
Yeah.
Like there was no plan as to where you had dinner. You just happened to, you were given a plate wherever you happened to be at the time. And there was no questions asked. Whereas that's almost unheard of now. You know, can I have dinner in such and such a house? They've invited me. Oh, really? I must check with the parents.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have to text the parent. Is it okay if I feed them?
Is it okay if I feed them and things like that? Whereas, so that's more, I think it's happening less and less with your community, with your neighbors to some extent. I could be wrong, but that's my impression.
I definitely do. I think still in the rural part, you might see that still a little bit more. But I think definitely now in big built up areas, especially when people are not from there, they've moved into kind of commuter towns, we're seeing less of it.
Yeah. And I think you still see a huge collective approach when it comes to immigrant families.
Yes.
And I think that's really important to acknowledge because
they kind of build the community around themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, addressing the unique challenges faced by immigrant families who navigate between maintaining their cultural heritage and adapting to the dominant culture's parenting norm can be a challenge sometimes because we may view a certain technique as being, you know, different or that's not what we do here. But we have to recognize that that's how some people raise their kids and how some people parent their kids. And we need to be sensitive, I suppose, and emphasize the importance of cultural sensitivity in healthcare, education, community settings, recognizing that different practices are often deeply rooted in cultural values and beliefs, and it's sometimes hard to change, but sometimes understanding them may pave the way to, you know, changing how people approach things. What do you think?
Just better education.
Yeah.
I suppose Ireland was very closed. Like I remember, so we didn't go abroad on holidays, and I remember probably 16, I never really saw any immigrants around. Like my parents were from the West. Like we wouldn't have seen it in comparison to if you were brought up in England.
Yeah.
But I think that's changing now. Like my kids would be exposed to loads of different cultures and they talk about it in schools, different religions, cultures, everything. And I think it's much better for society that we're kind of moving along.
And I think especially with everything that is happening in the world, communication and recognizing that we're all different, but we're all here to get along with each other is the first step into into solving all of our problems. Well, on that note, I think that was a lovely chat.
It was.
Yeah, a unique chat that we don't usually have.
No, we don't. And guys, he stayed away from the studies today.
No studies.
Absolutely. I can't believe it.
Yeah, well, there was one study.
Throw it in there, Fief.
This is a very interesting study, actually, that I've read. And
sorry, guys.
And I think it is interesting. And it just shows you how being removed from your own culture and being placed in a different culture can actually have organic changes to your body and your child's body. So they looked at a study in Hispanic women in the States, and they assessed how much they felt that they were acculturated, meaning that how much they changed from their own inherent culture into the culture of the United States of America. So how they had to adapt either forcibly or willingly to their new culture. And they also looked at the degree that they felt marginalized. So they've asked a bunch of women that were pregnant at the time whether they felt acculturated, as in assimilated into the culture of the United States, and how marginalized they felt. And they then did MRI scans of all their babies after they delivered. And what they found was certain connections in their baby's brains on MRI were affected by the degree of the mother's perceived acculturation and the mother's perceived marginalization. So the more they felt marginalized, the less those connections were between vital parts and the brain in the baby. It just shows you how you can have this imprinting into the fetus based on your own environment and what you're exposed to, which I thought was really, really fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me to throw in a quick
as always, segment. As always, Afif.
Yeah. And that just should actually inform us into what we may say to somebody, how we treat somebody may have long lasting impact down the line. That and may I think potentially affect future generations.
Very much for healthcare professionals. We need to be more open, more educated, and watch our tonal language and our use of language, I think, around immigrants and different cultures.
And on that note, I'm really, really delighted to have the following guest, and we will explore a lot more about inclusion medicine with her.
Fantastic. I can't wait to listen.
I am delighted to welcome Dr. Aveen Walsh, a consultant paediatrician with a special interest in inclusion health with Children's Health Ireland. She is the only paediatrician in Ireland employed to focus on inclusion health and has a temporarily funded team to care for some of the most vulnerable children in Ireland. So, what is inclusion health? Well, inclusion health is a method of healthcare delivery that seeks to overcome the many barriers faced by people accessing equitable healthcare. All of Dr. Walsh's patients and their parents are experiencing significant social adversity. Dr. Walsh runs the Lind Clinic at CHI, which is a community outreach clinic for children at risk of social exclusion based in Dublin's North Inner City.
Aveen, thank you so much for joining us on the Baby Tribe podcast. I am really excited that you have agreed to come on because you are a pediatrician, but you are also specialized in inclusion health. So can you explain a bit about inclusion health and why you think it's crucial in pediatric care?
So first of all, thanks for having me, Afif. I'm delighted to be here. And I suppose it's really great for me to have the opportunity to talk about something I'm so passionate about in terms of both my career and I suppose how society looks at how we look after everyone in our society. So inclusion health is really a term that we use to try and promote engagement of people from all parts of society with necessary health services. Because we know, and there's a lot of evidence out there, that people experiencing social adversity or social exclusion, a lot of them from marginalized backgrounds, have much worse health outcomes. And this starts often before childhood and actually preconception. So it's something that our healthcare system is not really designed to accommodate. So what inclusion health does is to try and make our health system more equitable and more readily accessible for people who might have challenges in accessing it in more traditional manners. The biggest challenge in my group is probably homelessness. There's a lot of other issues that homelessness brings along with it, but not having a permanent address in a system, in a health system and a social system that's very much dependent on postal correspondence actually means that a lot of children and families are set up to fail from the word go if they've moved on from an address and they don't actually even receive appointments is probably the biggest barrier to care. We also were in a much more diverse society in terms of language and culture. I think 13% of people in Ireland now English isn't their first language. And all of our kind of patient information, communication and everything is still done through English. And a lot of that, even when it's done in English, doesn't take literacy and education levels into account. So there's a lot of layers.
Homelessness is such a topical issue at the moment. And I think the latest figure is in the order of 13,000-14,000 children, I think.
So there's a difference, I suppose, between official figures and what we would report as hidden homelessness. So official figures are those registered as homeless within the relevant city councils. That does not include the population of children living within the direct provision system, which I would also qualify as being homeless and in a type of emergency accommodation. And then we have hidden homelessness, which is not recorded, but it's people who use an address such as a granny or a friend or a relative, but they're living on a couch and don't have their own rented or supported home.
And how does homelessness specifically affect children's physical and mental health?
How long do you have? So it's so manifold in terms of their physical health. Not all emergency accommodation, as it were, are created equally. So you've difference between families, children and families accommodated in hotels, in B&Bs, in what we call family hubs, which are a little bit more structured to support families. At the moment, there's families living in transit centres who are migrating into the country. And across the country, because of the housing crisis and need to accommodate people, there are now buildings being repurposed for accommodation as well. So that brings in your kind of basic needs. So something as simple as a kitchen, which I think in normal pediatric clinics, and I'm sure you do it yourself, it's not the first thing people ask is, do you have a kitchen or access to a kitchen? But a lot of the children I see are underweight and their growth is impaired. And the standard advice that we usually give in clinics is based around assumptions around having a fridge, having a kitchen, being able to afford food, being able to afford the electricity to cook the food. And you kind of have to throw all that out the window and start from the beginning. Even places where there is kitchen access, it's often you have to register for a time because there's multiple people need to use the kitchen. And if you're a single parent with five children, some of them very young, some of them might have additional needs or neurodiversity, it's not a safe environment to bring them in to try to cook, especially if there's other people there who might not be as mindful of child safety in a kitchen. So that's one example of how it can impact physical health. I have very high rates above the EU norm of children with iron deficiency and anemia and children with severe vitamin D deficiency. And they are micronutrients that can be often supplemented through a healthy diet. We also have much higher levels of faltering growth or obesity than the population norm as well. And I would view them both as types of malnutrition. So that's one example of physical health. Another is child development. No safe places to play. No places to congregate and play with either siblings or peers. With relatively recent events in Dublin city centre as well, I know a lot of families who may not be Caucasian Irish in appearance are very reluctant to go outside into the city centre, to the local parks. So there's very little outside space to engage in play. And we find smaller children, babies, you probably chat a lot about tummy time, the importance of tummy time. In a crowded hotel room where a lot of possessions are stored against walls, when you've multiple children in a room, it's not a safe place to put a baby down and to actually engage in tummy time. So we see a lot of motor delay as well.
So these are all, you know, on the surface are simple things that are easy to fix, but you've just outlined the challenges in actually trying to address them. What can parents in those situations do to try and mitigate some of those challenges?
I think the first thing that I think of when I see parents and caregivers is most of them are doing such a good job in such difficult circumstances. And I often marvel at what they've managed to achieve and wonder, would I myself be able to do that? And I think support and encouragement, and also being very frank that sometimes they can't do it alone. There's amazing resources that my team, but we run an outreach clinic in the city centre. So we've gotten to know a lot of family resource centres, a lot of local community groups who are freely accessible and provide excellent supports for families. So there's toddler development groups that, and I think sometimes people just aren't aware of these organizations, because what they do multiple things. They act as a space where people can leave their emergency accommodation and go to a place where they can be shown and demonstrated what they can do to promote development or safe play for children, or stimulating children in a way that's not a screen, because it's very hard to keep a number of books and say art supplies in a hotel room or a hub. But it also gives them the opportunity to meet other people in their situation and to sometimes realize that really they're not alone. And that what they're going through is a struggle and challenge. But I see a lot of single parents, single caregivers, and parents themselves who've been through a huge amount of trauma in their lives. We see a lot of people who've experienced sexual and domestic gender-based violence and have carried that with them and are still doing an amazing job of being a parent. And I think showing people how well their child is doing in the circumstances, and also being able to offer really proactive help. I have a very low threshold to give children supplementation for deficiencies versus advising them to obtain more in their diet. I give a lot of nutritional supplements. We often refer to dietitians, but our primary care dietitians across the city and country, I could be incorrect in my figure, but I think there's nearly 70% of those positions are underfilled or not filled. So referring to a dietitian if there's nobody there to see them isn't going to help. So I'll start them on an oral nutritional supplement. And you have to realize that the normal common sense conservative advice that we usually like to follow as our first step in pediatrics is not going to, I don't want to set up a child and a family to fail a plan. It's not fair on them.
Yeah, I mean, just simply advising them to eat better, eat more vegetables, eat more fruits and not eat takeaway. I mean, that's not really helpful advice given the challenges you have outlined. Just building on that, the nutritional challenges I find very interesting. Are there any other specific nutritional challenges that you come across other than what you've described so far?
A few. So I think the first thing is the rate of dental decay, which I know you wouldn't immediately think of when you think of nutrition. To me, they go hand in hand. And I actually get a lot of referrals now from the hospital A&Es of children who've presented with dental pain and dental issues. I have a partnership with HSE Dentistry in my clinic. So most of the children who come to my clinic get a dental assessment, which is unbelievable. And they're many of the children end up being referred for dental extraction of their baby teeth because of the severe decay. And even if these children look very healthy to me in terms of, say, their body mass or their height and their weight, I'll still perform nutritional bloods on them because often their teeth are decayed because they're either drinking a huge amount of milk and milk at night, or their diet is very high in sugar and refined carbohydrates, which again can be very understandable if you don't have somewhere to cook for your children and your alternative is cheap fast food or processed food. That's one aspect of it. The other thing is children who have sensory aversions to food, and I see a lot of children who haven't been diagnosed, who may ultimately get a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, or are just children who are a little bit more on the neurodiverse spectrum. And I love food. I love managing children around food. I love messy play. I love being sensory. I love telling people to let their child explore, make a mess. Don't be, you know, don't be stressed if they don't eat. Just offer them, let the child have a bit of ownership and control over the food. Can't do that in a hotel room if they're going to make a mess of the floor. If they've spent their limited funds on food for a toddler or a four-year-old to refuse to eat it and throw it on the floor. So trying to manage even what is relatively within the norm of picky and fussy eating and sometimes is a little bit beyond the norm is really, really challenging.
This social exclusion that you describe is quite stark when you describe it the way you have. And we've touched on it a little bit, but the mental and emotional toll this might have on children, what can parents do to try and help with that, with your support, yeah, of course?
So I think sometimes naming it as, I wouldn't say a problem, but as an issue that's manifesting in the child, because often children do come into me with quite challenging behaviour, developmental delay, and I'll never see when I meet a child for the first time that I can pinpoint what's going on, but there's never only one factor. And I think being able to empower parents and caregivers that a lot of what is potentially going on is related to their environment, because I think there's a lot of maybe unconscious or conscious judgment or bias towards these parents if their children are seen as difficult and acting out. And to be able to say, I know what you're experiencing is incredibly difficult and it's also impacting your child. That's not your fault. You're living in a home. You don't have a home of your own. You don't have the basic amenities that many of us take for granted. And sometimes naming that as a factor actually empowers parents to go, okay, this isn't all my fault, which it never is. But there's often this underlying feeling of that we all feel as parents. I myself have sometimes been so guilty about minor things because we take it on board ourselves. And I think the basic, as a mother and a parent, I feel my basic job is to feed my child, clothe my child, and that my child sleeps well. And I think parents can often feel if they're not managing those things, again, sleeping in a communal environment is really, really difficult. And I think parents feel if they're not achieving those basic things they should be doing, that they're failing their child, yeah, which isn't fair.
I want to move on a little bit to the importance of culturally competent care. And I have had personal experience with this when I was training in Toronto. One example of how I think people need to be aware of the cultural diversity. When donor human milk was becoming more prevalent in the neonatal intensive care, and us recognizing that it's better than formula to give to preterm infants, a lot of the Muslim families used to decline it, full stop, and not accept it, even though it was, on the surface, a better option for the preterm infants. And I remember a lot of my colleagues were expressing frustration as to why the Muslim families were turning this down when it's better for their babies. And I had to explain to them the concept of milk kinship that exists in Islam, whereby if a baby consumes the breast milk of a woman that is not their biological mother, then the actual biological children of that mother are regarded as brother and sister of that breastfed baby. And that has implications down the line. So when they grow up, they can't get married because they are regarded as siblings. And the problem with donor milk is because it comes from anonymous sources and it is pooled, the Muslim families were worried about the possibility of their child meeting, you know, a potential sibling and marrying them. And that was their hesitation, but they couldn't verbalize it and they couldn't express that concern. And me being Muslim myself, I was aware of it and I decided to try and tackle it. And we were able to rationalize it with a couple of Muslim scholars, whereby, you know, there's a decree that donor milk loses its kinship qualities because it's regarded as a medicinal product. Some people accept that, some people don't. But that was an example of being aware of the cultural diversity. And now with Ireland becoming a lot more diverse, how important is it that we need to be aware of all of these things?
You're right. And I love that you bring up that example, because I think it shows how much more there is to medicine than medicine. And a lot of the time, I will always say in my clinic, the medicine for me is the easy bit. I see the child, I know 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 what I need to do, but it's actually achieving those goals, and how to wrap around a family and a child's needs to help them achieve that can be the tricky piece. I'll give an example. About 30% of my patients at the moment, by virtue of the location of my clinic and the homelessness in the north inner city, come from the Roma community. And they have by far and away the worst health outcomes of children that I've seen. And I think it would be very easy on the surface to be quite dismissive, going, there's lots of other families in homelessness. Why are these children even worse off? What's different? What are these parents and families doing wrong? I'm not going to speak, you know, on behalf of the Roma community, but I have had the pleasure of dealing with many of them and asking the questions and learning about their culture and previous interactions with healthcare professionals. When you go back in terms of context of generational trauma and engagement with the health services, I think many people may or may not know, but in the Holocaust, the Roma were very much targeted as a population, and not just targeted for extermination, but selected out preferentially for medical experiments. And the exact number of the Roma that were killed in the Holocaust is not known, because in many countries they weren't registered as citizens or not really counted as valued members of the population. And that's still within living memory for some of the older members of the community. And I think to have such a stark and horrible memory of medical professionals. And I think there are still parts of the world where they are segregated in terms of their medical care. So we're in a very privileged position as doctors in Ireland, that most of the people we encounter already have a respect for a medical professional and put a value on your opinion. And I've never been anything but respected or felt valued when I engage with Roma families. But knowing there is a reticence there to trust you as a professional. And I think people can also feel that people aren't engaging with a plan. Why aren't they doing this? And I think you need to look at the education and literacy rates of Roma people. There was a study done in the EU in the mid 2000s that the average duration of a Roma woman in primary education was 4 years. And that didn't record attendance rates at that time. That only recorded people, Roma women registered or Roma girls registered in primary education. So when you lack the basic fundamentals of primary education, such as basic literacy and even counting, it's no wonder that people have difficulty sometimes understanding slightly more complex plans in relation to their child's care. But understanding that and learning how to navigate the concept of health literacy and basic concepts of health and going right back and explaining them really empowers them on their child's health and helps them to ask questions. Because I found in the beginning a lot of people didn't ask me questions, and I could sense they didn't understand or were concerned about what I was saying. And giving people a platform to say, give them their questions. There are no stupid questions. And if you don't understand something, it's because we haven't explained it properly. So we're going to stay here until we know that you're... I just feel no parent should leave a consultation not being either satisfied or fully understanding the plan for care for their child.
And may I ask, because I find that challenging myself, is how do you navigate that when language is a barrier in the presence of an interpreter, for example?
So I've learned, and it's something I've learned over time, is I find interpreters are often very well educated, articulate people. They're multilingual, they're very good at languages, and versus someone who maybe English is their first language, who may for various reasons have a lower level of understanding. I find you have to be very mindful that your interpreter's level of English, when they relay back to you what a parent says, might be a higher level of language and articulation than the parent may have conveyed. And I think I have to be very conscious to adjust my language level and the simplicity of what I'm explaining, not to what the interpreter is saying, but what I feel the parent will best understand, because then they will translate my more basic language.
And I find that quite a challenge, because often you find that the interpreter and the patient engage in almost sometimes a 2-minute conversation, and then the interpreter will retort back with a one-liner. And you're like, how?
That's not what happened.
How can you encapsulate what happened with just this one-liner? And you feel that you're missing something that the patient is trying to tell you. Yeah.
And again, so I think about 70% of the children who come to my clinic, there's their interpreters. So first of all, I've gotten to know the interpreters, which is fantastic, because there are certain interpreters, and a small minority, who I've just come away not being satisfied with the interpretation that's been done. And I know I've a great relationship with the majority of interpreters come to the clinic, and I know how they work, and they now know how I operate and how I speak and the nuances to my own language. I think having familiar faces, and that is the benefit of a clinic where so many children need interpreters, that I'm a lot more comfortable. The interpreters know me, and I'm also much more comfortable if I do feel there's kind of a sideline in the dialogue. I'll actually say, I'll excuse me, would you mind just stopping there, because I really need to know what is happening. And if they're asking a question, I'd prefer to explain it myself.
I'm going to ask you about advice that you might give to parents of other children that may be native to the land, and then healthcare providers. What advice would you give to Irish parents to try and help support other families that may be at risk of social exclusion?
And I think when you say that, as others, unfortunately across the board, there's plenty of Irish families in this situation as well, and probably less well recognised if they are less obviously a migrant in the country or having language difficulties. And I say what I say to myself, which is, I put myself in their shoes, and nobody takes the decision to uproot their family lightly. Nobody takes a decision to leave their support network, their extended family, their livelihood, their familiarity, their culture, their language behind, to move to somewhere unfamiliar with, let's face it, not the best weather in the world, and to live in a congregated setting with no recourse for support, a very unfamiliar system, and a difficult system to navigate. I often find myself apologising to families for the sheer amount of paperwork that is displayed to them, because everything is still done by paper-based English language forms. And I just will always take a minute, and when I would advise anyone, to imagine how they would struggle with the same difficulties presented to them.
Actually, it's really important that you brought up that, you know, Irish families can be marginalised as well. And one marginalised community are members of the travelling community. Do you work with members of the travelling community, and are their issues similar to other minority groups?
Absolutely. And I would work with a lot of Irish travellers in my clinic. And again, very similar challenges. While there is less homelessness, there is a very entrenched exclusion towards them as a minority in Ireland. And I think while there has been good progress made, and there's some very prominent members of the Irish travelling community now in different advocacy groups and in different platforms, I think there's a long way to go to acceptance and acknowledgement of them as valued members of our society.
Absolutely. And did you feel that there is a level of distrust with the medical profession?
I'd say there's distrust with the medical profession from all of the groups that I see. What I will say is, though, I have never had a difficult interaction. I've never encountered hostility. And it almost makes me sad, because people are so grateful to, essentially, to my mind, have a professional clinical encounter with specialists or a general paediatrician like myself that they're entitled to for their child. And while it's so lovely to have this appreciation and to know that people enjoyed an experience with you, I think it's also really sad that it's something that is so profoundly unusual for them to experience, that they're that grateful. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that has been my experience. I have nothing but amazing interactions with all of the minority groups that we have been talking about. Once you actually take the time to sit down and engage and try and understand their challenges, it's very rewarding when that actually happens. Which brings me to our role as healthcare providers. How can we work together to better support children who are at risk of social exclusion?
So I think you said it there. The biggest thing that we can do is give them time. Because without time, you're not going to figure out the different challenges that are unique to them. I think it's easy to blanket go, these children and families are socially excluded and the majority are in homelessness. These are the challenges pertinent to all. Because if you do that, you don't understand that every child and family is different and everyone has a different story. We practice trauma-informed care in our clinic, which is the concept you don't look at a chart or a referral letter and go, what's wrong? You know, what do I need to address today? You look and you go, what has brought you here today? And by that, it doesn't mean the medical presentation or the concern around growth or development. It means from the very beginning of your life and your story, what has brought you to this point in time, in this situation, into this clinic.
Wow.
Because a lot of these, I have a lot of children whose parents are the product of the care system and social exclusion. And I think if you're a parent has an innate will and want to protect their child, and when you've grown up battling for recognition and surviving from early childhood and experience lots of adverse childhood events, you develop almost an abnormal fight or flight response. And I think things can very quickly, if you don't give someone time and recognize that they can find situations like a professional engagement with the medical profession very scary and challenging, that you can quickly have a situation escalate, when really understanding that people act this way out of fear and previous negative experiences, and knowing that and taking the time to understand. And we do, as I said, unfortunately get a huge amount of disclosures of sexual and gender-based violence towards, in particularly, the mothers of children in our clinic. And I feel that you can't look after a child if you're not addressing really significant either historic or present issues that a mother might be facing as well.
On that, I read a very interesting study recently that was done in a small number of pregnant women and their offspring in the States, where they examined a group of Hispanic mothers that were pregnant at the time, and they assessed the level of social exclusion that they felt that they were under. And they then did MRI scans of the brain of their babies after they were born. And they actually found an association between the degree of social exclusion and some wiring in their babies' brains in certain parts of the brain. So the more social exclusion the mother experienced during her pregnancy, the worse those connections between vital parts of the brain were. I mean, do you buy into that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that 1 in 3 premature deaths worldwide are directly attributable to social exclusion. And I think the other thing we have to look at when you look at, and I'm delighted you mentioned a study like that, because when you look at medical literature, you'll find that by and large, most studies are Caucasian, middle and upper class people who are enrolled in the studies. And it depends on the different health systems. Sometimes because it's in North America, it's accessibility to healthcare. I think there's also been a historic reluctance to take advantage of vulnerable people, as it were, by engaging them in literature without being sure that they're properly fulfilling informed consent. But I think there's a move now to really, we're not understanding what treatments are best for society as a whole if we're only focusing on one core cohort. And again, it's the challenges that preclude people from engaging with healthcare that preclude them engaging in meaningful research their health.
Very, very well said. So finally, before we finish, what preventative health measures do you recommend for children at risk of social exclusion?
Very good question. From a medical perspective, I think professionals to be aware of simple things like vitamin D, especially in darker skinned children who might live in overcrowded accommodation, who might not get outside very much. I think being very aware of malnutrition in this group, even if children are presenting with what may look like normal growth parameters. The other thing I would say in medicine is we have a concept of mid-parental height, where you at the heights of the parents and decide whether or not the child's growth is normal for their constitution and for their parental height. But if you think these parents have probably had a lifetime of malnutrition as well, I would have a consideration that maybe mid-parental height is not as effective in these groups if you have a mother who's experienced malnutrition her whole life as well. So I think raising awareness that our basic approaches for common conditions do not work if a little bit of extra thought isn't applied for children in social exclusion. and homelessness.
And what kind of initiatives then would you like to see?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Yeah. I think, and what we're learning from the Lynn Clinic, which is my outreach clinic, is different ways of engagement. So we have excellent attendance rates at our outpatient clinic, which I'd say if we looked at the numbers, which I keep meaning to do, we would have better attendance rates than average hospital outpatients, which for a population who are coming to our clinic because of their social exclusion and difficulty with engagement says it all in itself. So I think if there's a child people are worried about coming to clinic, you know, proactively engage with them and liaise. Don't just go, oh, they didn't attend again, but they have something going on, so we should probably see them again in 6 months. If they didn't attend that time, they're not going to attend in 6 months' time. So I think greater awareness across both medical professionals and also society that things aren't as simple as you think they are, and that people are struggling to get to the end of every day. I give lectures to medical students and I say, the families I see aren't worried about climate change. They're worried about getting their children fed appropriately that day. And I always, always ask a family, what is their priority as well? Because my priority for the child might not be theirs. And I'll finish up with one story about a little boy who came to my clinic with delayed walking. And I would not say I'm a neurologist, Afif. So if I think something is quite abnormal, it's usually pretty abnormal. And I could tell his gait was very unusual. And this was a very chaotic family with a lot of challenges in terms of literacy, language, understanding. They were very transient within the homeless services. And I knew he needed a lot of different input, neurodevelopmental physiotherapy, neurology. But I knew sending them to lots of different outpatients before we had a diagnosis was not going to be in the family's best interest. So we brought him into our day ward where our neurologist saw him. We got everybody to assess him. We ultimately got a genetic diagnosis and a reason for his mobility problems. And we set him up with the disability services. We did all this and I was patting myself on the back thinking I was just amazing. And I saw the mum about 9 months later, at which she had a small little 3-month-old baby as well. And it was a great consultation. He was doing really well. And I asked her what had made the biggest difference to her. And it wasn't anything medical, physiotherapy, interventions. Back at the beginning, we had linked them with a key worker because the mum was having to take 2 buses to get into Temple Street with a 3.5-year-old who couldn't really walk. And unbeknownst to us, she was pregnant at the time. And that key worker got her a double buggy. And for her to be able to move her children on public transport to get to appointments meant she could engage with healthcare. And that to her, of everything she received, and I will say from all services, this family were wrapped around and really supported. But that was what stood out to her as made a difference in their family's lives.
Wow, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then finally, to finish off, what is the most rewarding aspect of your career?
The children and the families I get to meet. Honestly, and it might sound cheesy, but you're meeting people who have such struggles and yet they're always pleasant, happy, their children are beautiful. And it's really nice to get to meet people from so many different backgrounds and cultures. And it challenges me every day as well to rethink my own concepts and what I view as normal. And I'm very lucky to be able to get that perspective.
Aveen, thank you so much for coming on the Baby Tribe podcast. It has been an incredible conversation.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Afif.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Baby Tribe podcast. We're delighted to have shared this time with you, offering guidance and support for your parenting journey.
I've been Afif and she's been Katie, and together we've been your guides in exploring the multifaceted world of parenting. Remember, every step you take in nurturing your child makes a world of difference.
Stay connected with us and don't miss our next episode, where we'll continue to delve into the valuable insights and practical tips for raising healthy and happy children. Thank you for being part of our tribe, and remember, you're doing an amazing job.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.